With us on the line now is Lucy Bernhold. She's a senior research scholar at the Stanford University Center on Philanthropy and Civil Society, where she directs this Digital Civil Society Lab. Her book, How We Give Now, is a philanthropic guide for the rest of us. In the book, she shows us that philanthropy is more than writing a check and claiming a tax deduction. For most of us, the non-wealthy givers, philanthropy can be a way of living our values and fully participating in society. Welcome to the show, Lucy.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for joining us. Tell us about your role at Stanford University Center. It sounds rather interesting and a bit complicated.
No. So I run the Digital Civil Society Lab, as you said, and we're trying to understand and inform and improve all the ways that our dependency on digital technologies is changing the way people take action together. So all kinds of civil society action, collective action, organizing, and of course, giving money, time, and increasingly, digital data.
Okay. So when you're talking philanthropy and giving, it's not just about giving money then. You're talking about giving data.
Yeah, we're talking about giving money, time, data. And what we're really trying to help people recognize is that the vast amount of philanthropy is done by everyday people. We talk about it as if it's only the purview of the really wealthy. They've sort of captured our imagination when it comes to philanthropy. But philanthropy depends on the acts of kindness and acts of caring and solidarity and mutual aid that everyday people do, especially during these last 18 months. We've seen lots of it.
Mm. So what does philanthropy really mean then?
Well, its original roots are love of humanity. And I would say that it means all the ways we try to take care of ourselves, our extended families, our neighbors, our communities, and to make the world a better place. That's what we did to do the research for the book. We asked hundreds of people and did hundreds of interviews with people asking them what they do to make the world a better place. And then we made sense of the 4,000 some odd answers we got. And what we found was that people do still give money to charities, of course, but it is by no means the only thing they do.
So were you quite pleasantly surprised by the answers and response that you got?
Yeah, it actually is a great source of hope. I think there's tremendous power in people coming together. It's part of how they participate. It's very much how they are trying to address things, everything from climate change to COVID to the, especially since I focused on the United States, you know, the lack of basic services like healthcare, things like that. People do care. They're very generous and they're very much invested in making the world better for themselves, their children, their neighborhoods, and the world around them.
So did you do the research with the view of writing a book, or did you do the research and then think, wow, there's enough material here for a book?
I started the research over a decade ago, and I was not thinking about making a book. I was actually at that time talking to people who mostly worked in big foundations, so who were kind of professional philanthropists. And I wanted to understand how they saw themselves as people in those roles. So I asked them what they did. And then as I watched the world of books for big philanthropists sort of increase, there's some great new books that have been written, but there's a lot of material out there for the very, very wealthy. And, you know, they've got all the help they need. I also think it's quite dangerous if we start to think that only the wealthy can participate in that they can drive the agenda of what we want. So I really wanted to understand what people of everyday means were doing. And they're very politically active. They're very, they help their neighbors. They spend a lot of time with other people. They form reciprocal relationships. Of course, different cultures and different immigrant communities have long traditions of kinship care. So I really felt like that was a story that we just don't hear very much about. We tend to hear about very, very wealthy people or people who totally upend their lives and devote themselves entirely to some extraordinary act of service. That's all well and good, but the rest of us are what's actually making our communities thrive.
Yeah, interesting. So can you give us an example of one of the stories that you came across that you were surprised about, but in a good way, obviously?
Sure, I can tell you lots of them. There's a great community of mostly immigrant women in a neighborhood in San Francisco where there's been a lot of violence and drug dealing. And over the course of several years, those women organized themselves as well as the shopkeepers in the neighborhood to create essentially kind of a human train to help the young children who were going to school in the neighborhood get from their homes to the school, and at the end of the day, get from school back to their homes safely. And so they call this Safe Passage. They actually painted yellow footprints on the sidewalk, and about 20 minutes before school gets out, the groups of neighbors will go to the street corners. They'll walk up and down the street and let people know the kids are coming, the kids are coming. And you'll see all these people who are unhoused and living in very difficult situations and who may be addicted to various substances. They all get out of the way. They stop what they're doing. They pick up their sleeping bags or whatever it is, and they clear out the sidewalk so that the kids have this safe passage to and from school. And over time, they've even added another route to help the elders in the neighborhood get to the community center. So that's just one example of people who, you know, who are living, have a tough time making ends meet as it is. But of course, they care about their kids, as we all do. And they found a way to very respectfully and safely take back the streets so that their kids can go to and from school safely. That's one of my favorite stories. Yeah. But I've got a lot of them.
Oh, that's a great one, isn't it? What a wonderful idea. I've never heard of such a thing. That's so beautiful.
Yeah, and it doesn't take any money.
No.
And the shopkeepers have all started to join in, and they've really built an extraordinary network of neighbors who do this themselves. So they've also been able to then turn to City Hall and say, hey, we need more garbage pickup. We need cleaner streets. We need all kinds of things. So once you start building that community power, you know, you can take on bigger and bigger projects, but it really comes from taking those first couple of steps of doing something together.
Yeah, absolutely. Give us another example. That was a great story.
Okay. So there's another story I really liked were two graduate student scientists, best friends, who wound up going to different parts of the United States to go to graduate school, but they wanted to stay in touch with each other and do something. And they also had artistic bents. And back a couple of years ago in the U.S., when the then administration was defunding science, and you'll remember the women's marches that were all over the world, these two young women got together and wanted to do something that would help young women, particularly Black women and women of color in science, actually get ahead a little bit and get into the programs they wanted to see them in. And so they used YouTube and their lack of concern about failing. And they taught themselves how to make little ceramic pins. And they made a bunch of pins and they made some t-shirts and they sold this. It was all about promoting women in science, particularly Black women and women of color in science. And they, with all the money they raised, they then used it to provide very small dollar grants, you know, $100 here, a few hundred dollars there, to young scientists who are just starting out in their careers, who maybe needed some funding to get to a conference or something like that. Well, over time, they got really good at making these little enamel pins and the t-shirts and whatnot, and they connected with an online magazine called Massive Science, which has, I don't know, 20,000 subscribers or something. It's a pretty well-read online magazine. And anyway, the two women managed to make this whole process something that community of 20,000 people took over. So they now sell the pins. They come up with other ways of raising just these little pots of money. But then that huge community, 20,000 people, has come up with a way to select the people who will get the next year's grants. And what that really does is it's much more than just a couple of people with some money picking some strangers. It really starts to build a very powerful collective bond of all of these tens of thousands of people, many of whom are like the founders of this, young women of color trying to break into the hard sciences. So it's really built support for them beyond just the money.
Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful. Wonderful. And
I can keep going. I got a book full of stories for you.
Oh, I love it. With regards to our data and providing digital information, just explain what you mean by that and how that's connected to philanthropy.
Sure. I mean, most of us have the experience of feeling like our data is just being taken from us by the big companies. And it's a very disempowering position. And it's true. The companies are just taking our data and we don't really have a fair say in it. But it's also true that sometimes a little bit of data from a lot of people can make a big difference. So one of the examples I use in the book is an app called iNaturalist, which is available around the globe, has an enormous community of users around the globe. And what you do is you use your camera in your cell phone. And if you're out on a hike, if you're in the woods, if you're at the beach, if you're in the city and you see a bird or a bug or a tree that you don't recognize, you can snap a quick photo of it. And then you can choose to, and it's entirely voluntary, just like if you were donating a dollar, you can upload it to the iNaturalist site. And two things will happen at that point. Within seconds, you'll get an answer about what it is. And those answers are coming from the hundreds of thousands of people around the globe who are also part of this community, who happen to be experts on bugs, birds, trees, mollusks, you name it. If you're looking for a science nerd, iNaturalist is a great place to find one. They will answer your question, but then they'll also give you the option. Again, it's entirely up to you. You can stop at that point. You can forget about the whole thing, or you can opt in to share your photograph. And if it's a good enough quality photograph, it becomes part of the world's biggest database on biodiversity taken at the ground level. And then that database is used by scientists around the world, along with all the other data sources they have. And from it, they've had many, many scientific papers published. They've identified new types of insects that no one had documented before. And most important, the scientists who are working on global warming, who are trying to understand how certain species of plants or animals, how their migration and growth patterns are changing, now have ground level evidence taken by you and me of what's happening to the birds and the bugs and the trees where we live. And if you go to the website iNaturalist.org, you can see in real time the things people are taking photos of, the things that the scientists are learning. And it's absolutely incredible. I'll say one other thing about it. Most of us who feel so disempowered by the way companies treat us about our data, if you go to these sites like this, and there's many of them, you'll actually see an honest exchange about what's happening with your data, what's happening with your photograph. And at any point, you can choose to not be part of it anymore. You can take it back. You can take off any identifying information. It really shows that there is another way. There is another possibility for how we relate to our digital platforms. And one of the things that may change that is if people realize, oh, I have this data that if I controlled it, I could actually use it for the things I care about. And maybe that's a way to change the conversation a little bit, because Lord knows we need to have a different set of relationships to digital data.
Absolutely. Oh, that's wonderful. I love the idea that you can decide that your photo is used for a real purpose that can help scientists to learn more about all these things. I mean, it's wonderful. I never knew that.
It's very cool. And there's a lot of these. There's a lot of them. Almost every country has some just for their birds. And so, but iNaturalist and eBird are the two big ones.
Okay, yep. Fantastic. Well, I've learned so much speaking with you today. Thanks so much for joining us. If people want to get a copy of the book, it's called How We Give Now, A Philanthropic Guide for the Rest of Us. It's by Lucy Bernholtz, who we've been chatting to. And the book is available on our website, tre.radio. Lucy, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.